A seismic shift has taken place in the world of work. Diversity and inclusion are no longer simply nice to have. These concepts are front and centre of how we do business. I'm Rachel Wilson, MD of diversity consultancy EW Group, and I'm excited to welcome you aboard Season 4 of the Reworked podcast, as we unpick the fabric of working culture to discover how inclusion can become the golden thread that runs throughout all aspects of business. So I'm really excited today to be talking to Letitia Osborne. Letitia is a psychologist who applies a DEI lens to her work and in particular has significant expertise in race equality. Her connection with EW and Challenge extends back to 2015 when she joined our staff team as training and business development officer. She's been away for a little while now studying for her doctorate, which is going to be a focus of our conversation today. And she's now back in rotation as a consultant working for us on a range of innovative client projects. So welcome, Letitia.
Thank you, Rachel. Thank you for such a generous introduction. It's really nice.
Can't wait to hear more about your PhD research. We've had a brief pre-chat, haven't we? But as ever, I always say, don't tell me too much now because we want to save the good stuff for this conversation. So looking forward to, I guess, should we just dive right in with it?
Let's go for it.
Okay, cool. So the subject of your PhD, and congratulations on that, because this is quite a recent awarding of the doctorate, isn't it, Doctor? Yeah.
My graduation was last Friday and it was wonderful to not be in the heatwave days because the robes and the hat would have been too much for me in those temperatures that we were having. So yeah, it was last Friday and I had an absolute ball. It was great.
Oh, I bet you did. Yeah, excellent. So the subject of your PhD is, you can tell us more about, but Black students' sense of identity and belonging within the higher education sector. I mean, maybe a good place to start would be sort of a bit of your backstory and what led you to that point in time where you decided that would be the subject of your PhD.
It's a good question, and I never know how to answer because I did not know what a PhD was until I started doing one. So I had a bit of a non-traditional journey into PhD. I always knew I wanted to do a master's, and so I did that. And when I worked back in 2015, as you said, as training and business development officer for Challenge EW, I would often be going to higher education clients, and I noticed that students would come up to me and say, and particularly students of colour, and say, oh, I'm glad you're here. I really wanted to talk to someone about this experience I've had. And I'd have to say, you know, I'm external, I'm only here for a day or a half day. And so it was always in the back of my mind of what was happening with students of colour and why was there no place within the institutions for them to talk about instances of racism. And so when I was applying to my PhD and the brief was already written, it was underrepresented student sense of identity and belonging. It was in the back of my mind, but at the time I was wanting to look at gender identity and look at trans students' experiences, but there were so few trans students that it didn't seem worth taking that risk of them being outed. And so I asked the university to just tell me who was the least represented, and Black students were less than 2%. And I thought, okay, this is definitely a group that I need to talk about. And I also had that experience when I was a consultant of many, many students of colour and Black students in particular wanting to talk to me about this. And so I already kind of knew there was an issue within all institutions. And so I thought, let's go for this and see what we can find.
Wow. I mean, it's a huge scope, isn't it, for a PhD, which from the little I know about that level of study, you do need to look at something very specific. And how did you start to narrow that piece of work down and into the focus that you ended up with?
Yeah, so I started to look at the numbers. I wanted to be quite data driven, but I also had experiences of trying different student groups. So I was invited to shadow a mature student's induction where they invite mature students in a week before the official start of Freshers Week, just so that they can have a little bit more time to get used to the campus and to find kind of friends within the mature student group. And within that group, there was one Black student, and she came up to me. I was supposed to be sort of a silent observer, but she came up to me and said, "I'm so glad you're here. You know, we're part of the sprinkle of Black people here." And it was just such a powerful moment for me to really take stock of how important it was for not just her, but the students in my studies to see me at this point. I knew it was rare, but I didn't know how impactful that was going to be for undergrad and younger students. And that was a really key moment where I thought, I really need to go down this route, not just because of the data, but because of the human side of it, right? Because it meant something to students as well. And it meant something to me as well.
Yeah, that's really powerful. I can imagine that being the case for those individuals. So the sense of identity and belonging was your starting point. How do you go about defining those terms? Again, very broad, mean different things to different people. How did you approach that?
It was very intense. There's so much debate from different fields of study about what identity means, what belonging means. And as you said, every individual person has their own idea of what that means. But when I started to look into the psychological literature and started to read and think, well, I need some kind of working definition for this, I really liked the social identity theory approach to it, because for me, it took both sides of it. So identity being how you view yourself, but belonging crucially meaning how others view and accept or don't accept you. I think that the two sides are really important, because I can see myself as a woman, for example, a Black woman, but if other women and other Black women don't see me that way, that has an impact. And particularly in higher education and people's student experience, the acceptance and the belonging is just as important as feeling like a university of student. And so it was really important to have both of those aspects, because as I found through my research, Black students couldn't take for granted the fact that they would be seen as just a student. In fact, they were seen particularly as a Black student, and that did not always have positive connotations. And so it was really important for me to add both sides of that, your self-recognition, but also recognition from others.
Right. Those are really excellent, clear definitions. I love that. You know, how you view yourself and how others view you. Absolutely. And I guess you were, I'm imagining your research was drawn to the disconnect between the two for individuals, was it?
Yes, it was. It was looking at whether that was possible, and if so, who is it possible for, and in what situations was it impossible, or did it feel impossible? And I realize I'm saying these short definitions, but it took me a long time to get there, and it took me a long time and a lot of reading and writing. And so it's really kind of muscle memory that has been kind of concise definitions. It wasn't natural at all. It was very forced and learnt and trial and error. And so I'm glad that it came across clearly.
It does. It feels like crystal clear, really distilled as well. I think that's, it's really powerful. Okay, so where did you go next with this then? If you were you conducting lots of individual interviews or group focus groups? How did you get under the skin of the, you know, that disconnect between social identity and belonging?
This is a good question. I had so many ideas when I first started, and alongside my PhD, there was what started was a few social media campaigns. So My Racist Campus was a big one, where students could anonymously submit any experiences of everyday racism, and they would talk about the institution, but the students themselves remained anonymous. And so that was one source for me to get an understanding of how this was working across the UK and not just at one institution. And so I thought about the fact that for a lot of students, as I said before, they hadn't had an opportunity to talk about racism with somebody who was of colour. And so I talked to my supervisors and we thought about going down the qualitative route of interviews, focus groups, potentially secondary analysis of the My Racist Campus campaign. And I thought, okay, I'm going to create a research advert and just get myself and my name out there. And I had really great response of people saying, yes, finally, I've wanted to talk about this. I haven't known where to go with it. And I want to talk to you particularly. And I don't know that I, at the time, realized how impactful, how important it would be, my own identity and the assumption that I would understand was a big motivating factor for students to join and take part in my research. So I ended up with individual one-to-one interviews and then followed up with three focus groups with students. And we talked about the good, the bad, the ugly, the neutral, and also talked about strategies of how they survived their time at university. And we did that through the focus group. So the interviews talked about initial experiences that stood out, both good and bad. And the focus groups then said, okay, if we have a feeling of what it's like to be on campus, how do you navigate that? How do you leave here with your degree?
I'm imagining that must have put you in some challenging situations in a way. Obviously, Letitia, you're an experienced diversity and inclusion consultant, but at this time in your life, you were acting as a researcher, an academic. And you're not only collecting research, you're also having conversations with people where you need to create a really psychologically safe space. And you're providing an outlet to some degree for those individuals' experiences. So was that a difficult thing for you to manage? And kind of those two, you almost have a dual role in those conversations, I guess, as the academic and as the professional.
Yes. Absolutely. At times it was, because I was sort of trying to find my stride, as you said, as a researcher, and trying to treat it as a professional encounter. But what I found very quickly in my first interview, actually, I found that I needed to also enter the room as Letitia the human, because some of the disclosures were difficult to hear. Sometimes people hadn't realized how bad the experience was until they shared it with me. And sometimes people were telling me things that they had never told anybody before. And so at times there was a tension between wanting to make sure that they were, as you said, psychologically safe, comfortable, confident, but also understanding where the boundaries were. But I felt incredibly privileged to be in a position where students trusted me. I think there was a lot of trust in that process with the information, trusted me with things they'd never said before, trusted me with their experiences and their stories. And so I felt also a lot of pressure to honour those stories, to really push for change, to make sure that I wasn't just kind of consuming their pain and not doing anything with it. I really was conscious of the responsibility that I and the university had to do more for these students. And it ended up being quite an emotional process as well. And I think a testament to the research itself was that students at the very end of the interviews and the focus groups, I asked, you know, finally, is there anything you would like to ask me? And everybody asked me, what about you? You know, you're also Black, you're also doing a degree, a doctorate. It may not be exactly the same as an undergrad, but you must have stories too. So it became, there was some intimacy in that process, and they felt confident to ask me the same things. So it felt kind of a mutual exchange in some parts.
Mm. Yeah, wow. I was thinking as you were speaking, your own, you know, taking care of yourself in this process must also have been a challenge, and potentially triggering conversations happening with students for you too must have been. Yeah, gosh, this. So as you're saying, a huge sense of responsibility actually to those individuals who contributed, that your work created some tools for change, some recommendations that can actually change the course of how Black students experience higher education. So I'm sure everybody listening is just like, tell us what the outcomes were. Tell us, what did you find? What are your recommendations? Let's get to that bit then. So what were your, yes, what were your findings? If you can, I mean, I'm sure your PhD is a very long document, so I don't know how you go about summarising this, but.
So first and foremost, the thing that I took from each of those conversations is Black students wanted me to know and wanted me to communicate that overall they had a positive experience, but they didn't want to shy away from the negative side. And so to summarize that part, there was quite a lot of shock about how casual and everyday racism was on campus and off campus, actually. And I think sometimes we underestimate off-campus spaces, so things like nightclubs, bars, libraries, shared working spaces, accommodation as well was one that people weren't expecting to have to deal with racism and inappropriate and offensive comments in your home, where you expect that to be a safe sanctuary. So that was the first big finding about how casual and everyday and ubiquitous racism is and was. Secondly, about what I found really fascinating was trying to understand the practices that sustained that racism. And in my second research paper, I describe it as an acceptable racism, and acceptable in inverted commas, because it's of course not, and objectively speaking, people would say that's unacceptable and inappropriate, but yet it was normalized on campus. And there was kind of a few different explanations for that, because one, Black students were vastly outnumbered. And so in situations where, for instance, the N-word was used, they felt, what can I do? You know, if there's 100 people in my lecture theatre, how can I stop 100 people? How can I challenge this all the time when I'm the only one in my accommodation building, my flat, I'm the only one in the library, I'm the only one in my course? So it was that kind of majority minority dynamic, but also that it took other white students not speaking out, not calling it out, that also made it quite normalized as well. The other finding was about the impact of their minority status. Most of my participants are from London, as am I. And so they said, you know, I took for granted the diversity as norm, which is very much what London is. And so moving outside of that to smaller cities, they found that, oh my goodness, oh yeah, of course, you know, London isn't representative of the entire UK. And so it was a bit of a visual shock, as well as the fact that they didn't have access to food products or hair products, or indeed hairdressers and barbers. They didn't cut kinky and Afro-textured hair. And so that, again, the reminder that this service or this product wasn't built with you in mind was quite shocking for them. They also had low trust in the institution. So they felt that even if I reported these instances, even if I told them about some of these experiences, both on and off campus, I don't trust that this is going to go anywhere. I don't trust the university is equipped to deal with this. And so that deterred a lot of the students from speaking out or reporting it more formally. And that was a big theme that ran across the interviews and the focus groups. And then finally, the biggest findings around the strategies, as I mentioned in the focus groups, asking, okay, if this is, we've got a feel for the campus culture, how do you navigate that with these things in mind? And there was a lot of conversation and at times debate among students about what was the best or the right strategy. And there was no consensus on this, but a few of the different ones they were using was two versions of the self. So people talked about having a London version of me and a university version of me, and they're two different people. I speak differently. I make sure to speak very well. I make sure to dress well at university. I don't want to confirm any stereotypes. And so they didn't feel they could be 100% themselves at university. And a lot of the behaviors that they performed tended to be in line with what they felt respectable and normative white culture were. So speaking a specific way, doing your hair a specific way, dressing a particular way were some of the strategies that they used. Also collective action. So there were moments when the African Caribbean Society or the race equality groups that they had would challenge some of the instances and ask the university to do more and to intervene as well. Other students said the reverse was true for them, that because they were so underrepresented, they thought, well, if I'm going to stand out, I might as well stand out. And so one of my participants said that she was her blackest self at university because there was no point trying to minimize or shrink herself. It meant that she was more connected to her culture, more connected to languages and films and food that reminded her of her culture. And that was a really important thing. And so nobody had exactly the same experience or exactly the same strategies, but they did have things that they kept in mind as they moved through their time at university, but also in shared accommodation.
Gosh, there's so much. That's such a rich description of a group of people's experience in a particular place, but there's so much that could be extrapolated from that, isn't there, Letitia, and applied elsewhere.
Absolutely.
I mean, gosh, where do we start? But actually, before we go there, can I just roll back ever so slightly, just because as you're talking about that group, I just feeling like I need to be clear on, were the people that you, the students that you interviewed, were they all from the same university? And what was the overall demographic of that student population in relation to, say, the national demographics? How diverse a group of students did they have overall?
Oh, that's a really good question. So what I was told quite a lot was that it was representative if you looked at white versus Black Asian minority ethnic. But when you drill down, which I did, drill down into the Black Asian minority ethnic section, you could see that there was quite good representation of Chinese international students, for example. But when you looked at home students, there wasn't an awful lot of representation across mixed and dual heritage. And Black were the two lowest groups. They had a fair amount of British Asian representation. But again, when you were drilling down into Indian, Bengali, Pakistani, we saw some disparities there as well. And so it was at the larger kind of Black Asian minority ethnic grouping, it was representative around 13-14%, which is in line with the UK. But when you drill down, you weren't seeing as much. For instance, there was more Chinese international students than there were home students of colour. And so that gave you a very specific picture of what the university looks like.
Yeah. My thought process is going just how representative is this? Obviously, in many ways, it is representative. Wouldn't dispute anything you've said about how this. I wouldn't question how any of these, how anything you've described in this campus culture might play out in wider society. But just like as a microcosm, how representative is it of
really
the wider population? So we can stand behind any parallels that we draw.
Yes, this is a really good question. So what I found really fascinating is in starting to write and present at conferences and seminars and things, I met a fair few different academics doing similar research at different institutions. So Sophia Ackle comes to mind, where she was doing work at Goldsmiths and Goldsmiths Students Union, which has a completely different demographic to the university that I was working with. And yet we saw exactly the same issues, even though we had much higher representation of Black students, of Asian students, of mixed dual heritage students. We were still seeing the same themes coming out, the same instances of racism, which I found really interesting, considering that this is a university that was in London in comparison to mine that was in the Southwest. And it's really fascinating. It's another reason for me, and I had this asked in my PhD defence, that I didn't name the institution, because I think when you name the institution, people tend to think, oh, it's just an issue at that one institution, when if we look at all of the evidence, including the Equality Human Rights Commission's report about racial harassment on campuses across the UK, we see that it's a sector-wide higher education issue and needs to be treated as such in a collaborative way, rather than every institution taking one approach. I think a collaboration would be much better, because there's not a university that doesn't struggle with this issue.
Mm. Absolutely. So if we were to extrapolate some of your findings, would it be fair, do you think, from your research and your wider experience as a DEI specialist, does it feel fair to say that if individuals in an organisation or a university or any type of culture are showing low levels of trust in that organisation, if they aren't feeling comfortable disclosing, discussing and calling out issues where they see them, and if they are adapting their behaviour, accent, clothing and so on to fit in, that actually you're going to find, therefore, that levels of belonging are going to be lower? There must be a correlation, I'm guessing, between those things and that whether people feel belonging.
Absolutely. And actually, I can say from discussing my research as a consultant across different sectors, I was actually surprised at how many employees across sectors said, I can relate to that. That makes so much sense to me. I've done that. I've dulled down my accent. I've tried to speak really articulately. I make sure to dress a particular way. So even though this was about student populations, I think there's a lot of extrapolation that we can have. And absolutely, your point about belonging, it's hugely influenced by your ability to be your full authentic self, to be able to bring your full self to work. And there's lots of employees who don't feel that they can do that or could comfortably say that they could do that. And so I think there's a lot of lessons that can be learned, of course, in higher education, but beyond that.
Yeah. Gosh, we could. Yes. I think we need a part two of this podcast interview where we start coming up with recommendations for the wider world of work. But if we take this one step further then, and we say, if those sort of, what do we call them, identifiers or those symptoms exist in an organisation and levels of belonging are therefore low, can we also then go one step further to say that actually what you may also have in your organisation is a normalised racism?
I think that in certain situations, certainly with the work that we do, I think that what I would say to organisations is, it's very difficult to be sure you don't have a problem with racism or sexism or homophobia. And I think there is the desire, the want to say, we don't have that kind of problem here. I have never heard it. But I think what my research was getting at, and luckily I was able to feed this back to senior management at the university, is it's not enough for us to just say we don't have the problem. How do we know for sure? Because we need to be asking our staff this. Hopefully we ask and our, you know, assumptions are proved to be right. But if we don't have the space, if staff don't feel able to come forward and say, actually, that's not the reality for me, we can be lulled into this false sense of kind of almost complacency of, it's fine, everybody's good, we don't have those types of problems. But when I was doing work with the Tides Project, working with NHS staff, they spoke about, for example, this culture of silence that people didn't want to necessarily report because they didn't think anything would happen. So it's not that higher education has a unique problem. This definitely cuts across different sectors, and it's really about whether your employees can truly and honestly and openly speak about these issues, or if they feel that it'd be better if they didn't. And I think that's a very relatable feeling, unfortunately.
Mm, definitely. I mean, it's understandable that organisations that organisations would feel nervous about lifting the lid on issues and encouraging people to come forward and speak about them. But we do say that to clients, don't we, really, that, you know, that's actually a hallmark of something good happening in the organisation. If you've got people feeling comfortable to speak up and speak out, to some degree, that's a marker of success. It's a marker of progress, at least, from a culture of silence to one where people are speaking out.
Exactly that. And one where people feel they can support colleagues as well, because sometimes people say, I've witnessed something, but I didn't know, you know, if this was my place. And so if you have that culture of speaking up, if you have that culture of discussing, of open conversation, we can have that conversation and figure out what is going on. And a lot of the time, people are relieved if their colleagues are doing this on their behalf as well. But we, again, have to have that culture where that's normal. And we have some work to do to get ourselves there.
Absolutely. So have you got... Okay, I'm going to put you on the spot now. Sorry about this. But have you got one... I'm looking for maybe one idea or one finding from your research or recommendation that actually is translatable to the wider world of work that we could finish the conversation on. So we make sure we're finishing on a practical, positive, something we can do, piece of advice that people can take away. Is there anything that jumps to mind?
It does. I think it cuts across all sectors because it's related to time. Mm-hmm. A lot of the students were born after to the year 2000, which is still bewildering to me. there was this assumption that, in 2022, these things don't happen. And I think that is a very pervasive idea in our minds, because, of course, progress happens over time. But what we can't do is say, oh, that doesn't exist anymore. And so the piece of advice I would give is to try to evidence that. Can we really say that? We would, of course, it would be amazing to say in the year 2022, there is no oppression of any kind. But I think sometimes we can be some false hope of, oh, that doesn't happen anymore. When for me, having to sit across from 18-year-olds born in 2002, 2003, 2004, saying the same things that we've seen from the 70s, as much as it's absolutely heartbreaking and really difficult to hear, it's important that we don't lose sight of the fact that this is an active fight, that things change over time because people fight for them to change over time and for them to stay changed. And so I think that's the kind of proactive advice I can give, is for us to just keep going and to not lose sight of what we're trying to achieve, and make sure that people are able to see the truth, even though it's painful.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Letitia. Like I say, we could definitely carry on with a part two. Maybe we should get that in the planning and we can work through more of your findings. And yeah, it's really fascinating just taking this piece of work as a microcosm of what we see beyond HE, beyond the workplace, in wider society. Yeah. It's a really, really rich piece of work. Thank you so much for doing the work. You know, you're doing that on behalf of everybody. And I guess let's also acknowledge and thank all of the people who contributed to your research.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
It's been a fantastic conversation. I've really enjoyed it. I'll look forward to speaking to you again soon. In the meantime, let's just say in the episode notes, I will include links to Letitia's Twitter page where she's active, and LinkedIn. Is there anywhere else that we need to seek you out?
That's a good question.
Are you going to publish your research? Oh, let's just ask that question. Have you got a book in the works?
I don't have a book, but I've published two research articles. So we'll definitely link to those. It gives you a bit more about what I was talking about and some more extracts from my participants, so you can hear through their words as well. So I can do that. That'll be great.
Fantastic. We'll do that. And we'll speak to you again soon.
Thank you so much.
I hope this month's episode has brought you new ways of thinking about inclusion at work and ideas for what you might do next in your organisation. Check out the episode description for social media accounts for us and for our guests. We'll be back again next month. This is an independent, advert-free podcast, and we rely on your support to keep making these broadcasts. We'd love it if you could subscribe, like, and review us. See you next time.